some overboard when you're sitting having lunch, or, you know, just anything like that.
The classic.
We actually were joking about setting up an OnlyFins account.
Here's to us all swimming through the shit and making more sense of it.
Wild and unprotected. Planet Earth, we can't neglect it. Ah, nature's sexy. We need this place, so please respect it.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to this week's episode of the Wild and Unprotected podcast. On today's show, we have Denny Ramirez, PhD and founder of Whale Shark Mexico. Denny, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very excited to be part of it.
Yeah, happy to have you, Denny.
Thank you.
Awesome, awesome. Well, this one should be jam-packed. Let's just go ahead and get the people acquainted. Denny, can you tell us about who you are and what you do?
Yes, I am the founder of Whale Shark Mexico. It's an NGO based in La Paz in the Gulf of California. But I've been studying the whale shark since 2001. I started in the Gulf of California, and then I continued to the Caribbean side of Mexico. The Caribbean side of Mexico, we have the biggest whale shark aggregation around the world. And since then, I've been continuing studying the whale sharks and supporting other organizations. I've been very passionate in the movements and to know where they go, how long they stay. And we starting also to support the program in Peru, in Hawaii, Madagascar, Utila. So it's been a passion for several many years, and then continue in almost 22 years now that I started to study these majestic animals.
Yeah, that's amazing. And before we go any further, I want to say thank you. Whale sharks are my favorite animal, like we had talked about on our call before we started recording. To see someone that's as passionate about the same animal that I am is amazing. To see you support other organizations outside of your own, I know how much that takes out of a person and how much time and commitment that takes. And for you to do that and still have that same passion through and through, I appreciate that. And I'm so glad that you're now able to take some time away and go sail the Pacific and join us via Starlink. That is amazing. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's amazing. We've been trying to record this since I was in La Paz. And then I started with a new journey to myself. Yeah, last year I was sailing in Fiji. It was my first time having like a month and a half in a sailboat, and I really love this lifestyle. And so I planned since last year to take a year to myself to have kind of a new journey on my life. I felt like I really been loving, and I've been very grateful all that I have done through my research as a researcher, as a human, and in conservation and the NGO. But I don't know, I felt like I'm ready for something new, but I needed like a time to myself. And then since June, I've been sailing in the South Pacific. I started French Polynesia, Tonga, Fiji, Vanuatu, and here now in Solomon's Island, which is just, and I'm so glad that in this boat they have the Starlink, then I can have this conversation with you. Otherwise, we will not be able, because here there are not cafes or any other place that we can go and have this interview.
That's pretty wild for our first show that's on a sailboat, right, Koji?
Yeah, it's funny because last we tried to hit record with you, you were running down between a bunch of hotel lobbies trying to find Wi-Fi to do the show with us. So to have you on now with good connection, we're grateful. So thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, no worries. You're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Well, awesome. Let's go and shift gears into your backstory, Denny. I know you mentioned a little bit about, you know, taking a year to yourself and stepping away from the NGO for a little bit. Before we dive into Whale Shark Mexico, let's go into your early career and what really got you started in the conservation space, if you can think back that far.
Yes, well, I'm originally from Mexico City. It's a huge city. But my parents, they were divers. So I spent my childhood diving with them. Normally, they were diving in Cozumel, in the Caribbean side of Mexico. And I remember, like, my parents be down and my brother and I just following the bubbles. And since I remember, since I was a little kid, I always said I want to be a marine biologist. And the first place that my parents bring me with a tank, it was in Xancanaf, which is a protected area in Cozumel. It was just an amazing and beautiful. I was maybe 6 or 7 years, and it was, I don't know, 5 meters or something. And it was a virgin on the water, and it was full of life, full of fish. One fish bite my hand, and I was afraid, so I just went out and took, like, my mom gloves, and then I come down again because I just wanted to be there. And always said I want to be a marine biologist. And then my parents got divorced and none of them continued diving. So I felt like maybe when I was 8 to my 17, I didn't have that contact with the ocean, but always wanted. And then I had a trip with my brother and 2 friends from mainland of Mexico in a safari car. It was super cool. We were 5. And then we just do all the trip to the Yucatan Peninsula, and we ended in Xancanaf in Cozumel. And it was horrible. It was the reef super damaged. It was full of sunblock. And I cry because it was such a beautiful paradise. And it was totally different that I remember. So I remember that was the first time that I thought, like, I want to be a marine biologist because I want to do conservation. And also there is when I was a child, we used to camp a lot in the Pacific side. And I remember once it was a sea turtle nesting there. And she didn't even finish when the locals started to take the eggs. And I also start crying, and we tried to protect the eggs. And then the locals started to be aggressive with the sea turtle, and it was a big drama. But are there 2 deep things that happened to me that I always wanted to use the science in conservation? And so I finished the high school, and decided to move to La Paz to be a marine biologist. I worked for 10 months to save money and to move there. And the first semester of my career, I started to take the dive course. And a friend of mine that is a photographer who told me, and I remember meeting him in Mexico City, and he showed me pictures of the whale sharks. And I was fascinated because I never heard about the whale sharks. And we're talking about 1998. And then I moved to La Paz, and then he just grilled me and said, you know, there are whale sharks in Mexico, in La Paz, so you should go and see them. And I organized with the dive group, and we saw the whale sharks. It was super green. They were feeding. And they were also giant manta rays and mobulas. It was a lot of things happening around us. But I was just totally fascinated and in love of the whale shark. I spent the entire time in the water, didn't want to return to the boat. Everybody was just going up and down, and I was just keep swimming with the whale shark. And I just went with a professor that it was running the Sharks and Rays lab when I was at the uni. And I said, I want to have all the manuscripts that you have for the whale sharks. I really want to learn about these animals. And he said, you know what? We don't have. We only have a few manuscripts that they talk about, like the records where you can see them. But there's not much that we know about them. So all the career, I just dreamed to be part of the knowledge of these animals. And Then in 2001 is when I had the opportunity. It was another, but it was hard because I wanted to study an animal alive. And during that time, all the sharks and rays lab, they were just going to fishermen's camps and collect data for that animals. But I wanted to be studying an animal alive and to be on the ocean. So it was kind of like, it's impossible. And we didn't know much information about the wild sharks, like when they were in La Paz, how often. But by the end, in 2001, I was lucky because it was another student doing his master in a research center that we have in La Paz. So I just heard about him and I went with his professor and I said, I want to study the wild shark genetics. It was even worse because I wanted to not just see the animal, also collect a tissue sample. And then he said, oh, okay, sounds interesting. And how you are going to collect the tissue sample? I am not sure, but I'll figure out. So I started the journey in that way. And during 2 years, we didn't have whale sharks in La Paz. And the professor wanted me to change my thesis. And I was like, no, I mean, it was one day that I had an exam, so I didn't went to the fieldwork, and they saw two animals. And then the next day we went, and we didn't see any. And the professor was, no, you have to change. And I was like, no, I already read so many about this, and I've been, I every month we were out. By the end, I started my master once I finished the career, and I went straight after the career to my master and didn't did any thesis. And I had then two professors that to support me. And I ended going to Bahía de Los Ángeles, which is north of La Paz, to collect and to see them. And there were like 20 whale sharks there. I collect like 15 tissue samples. I was crying because I was super happy. And since then, the animals returned to La Paz. I went to Gordobanks in Cabo. And then all the story just keep moving from one thing to the other. And then I got a grant to study the animals in the Caribbean side. And in the Caribbean side, I learned a lot about the importance of involving community and about the importance of the role of the government. And I felt like in the Caribbean side, they were doing very good things for the protection of the animal and their habitat. But that was not happening in La Paz. And that's why I didn't continue in the Caribbean side. So I felt like it was so much things to do. The Caribbean side had so much attention because it's the biggest wild shark aggregation. And then the Gulf of California didn't have that attention. So I wanted to build something to protect. And at some point when I finished my PhD, well, after the grant, I started my PhD. It was population genetics around the world. So I went to Philippines. I went to Australia. So it was kind of more international collaboration. But I always had the sensation that I wanted, that it was not real. Like you are just generating the information and then you publish. But then what happened? And that since I was in the career, we did an NGO, and it was more about environmental education and cleaning, beach cleaning. And through this NGO in La Paz, many times we had, for example, one big develop that wanted to develop in front of the Mogote area. The Mogote area is a sandbar where the wild sharks aggregate to feed every year. And because I was in the master during that time, or at the beginning of the master, the professor told me, like, the, what is called, I forgot the name, the Manifest of Impact Ambient, that is a study that you have to do before you start something that you need to know how much is affecting this to the environment. And he said that the part of the water, it was very bad, like the part of the ocean, and that was not involving the whale sharks. So I remember we went just to the government and we get the study, but we couldn't get the copy of the study. So we were just there studying about what is this affecting and making notes. We ended submitting like our comments for the manifest of impact, and it was not the whale sharks there, and that develop will affect that. So since I was starting my early career, I started very active in the conservation and protection. And thanks for this action, we continued with a legal process against this. And by the end, we were able to stop this. And then other marinas and other things comes with golf cans in not trying to use. So, but during this journey, I felt like the science and the conservation and management and community, they were not together or they were not linked. So I wanted to do that, to be able to use the science in conservation, working in hands with governments and hands with the communities. So it's more or less how the NGO started at the beginning, or the program. At the beginning, all the conservation things and environmental things that I did, it was through this NGO that I started at college. And then when I finished my PhD, I just add the science part. And yeah, since then it's been more like I'm super glad, like in Mexico we have three protected areas, marine protected areas, base for the whale sharks, and my research helped to build that. And in La Paz also, not just the refuge of the whale sharks, also it's been very active for the management, like what are the months where we can do the tourism, like what are the limit of the boat that could be in the area without affecting the whale sharks. And all of these things that without the science, without the data, really you don't know. And also using tools to measure the effective management plan, like we do the analysis of the injuries presented on the whale sharks, and we can see if, because we work with the photo identification, we can know how the whale sharks arrive in La Paz. And then after a time, they started to have like a propeller boat. So we can see if the management is been in a good way or not, or make our connects or comments to the government. So more or less, that's been kind of the journey that I've been having with the whale sharks, and how I started and how it's been evolving or changing through to whale shark Mexico, that now the intention is to do the three things: the science, the conservation management, and environmental education.
Yeah, that's awesome. It sounds like you have your own little trifecta of how things work for your organization and how you brought it all together, which is kind of funny because our organization was kind of built off of something similar. We wanted to find, you know, three pieces of a puzzle that could come together to help propel our organization forward here at Wildscape, to be able to say, okay, what are some things that we think are separate? You know, just like you thought, you know, the research, the conservation, and the community were all separate. You know, for us, we want to bring podcast content, video content, and community events all together around conservation. So it's interesting to see how, you know, kind of the three pieces come together for your journey to Whale Shark Mexico. And that coincides with what we're doing too, because at the end of the day, we both want the same things. You know, we want conservation to be pushed forward into a different light. For you guys, it seems like there's a lot of government work, which is really important, because you guys can do research all the live long day. But if you don't get the government involved to be able to create these protected areas, like you were talking about, well, then what good is this research? Animals are still going to get hit by propellers. There's still going to be potential injuries and loss of habitat if you guys aren't working on your trifecta. So that's pretty amazing to see. We love to hear that. And we're excited to hear kind of about the next topic. Koji, you want to cue that up for Denny?
apparently. But anyway, I want to say that it's awesome that you are doing in this way, the how you started your program. It's very, I think I can see how everything is being changed and how the thing, how, like, and now I can say it in Mexico, not just me, like, and now I can see that there are a lot of actions which are trying or already have this connection with government and research. And but 10 years ago we didn't have, or 15 years ago we didn't have that. And so now we are moving to a different areas that need to have these connections, or which is great. So yeah.
Before we get too far into this week's episode, I wanted to give a quick shout out to our sponsor. Our sponsor this week is you, our listeners. How? Well, now that we're a nonprofit, the donations that we receive go directly towards funding our shows. Want to help or need more information? Visit wildscapeproduction.com/donate to support the show. We're so thankful for the support. You make the show exactly what it is. Well, thank you, Denny, for explaining that. I'm sure it's been nice to hear some of your experience early on in your career. And I think, you know, hearing you explain your childhood, I think that is going to resonate with a lot of people in our audience, because that's where it really does get started for a lot of people. So I can resonate with that. But let's shift gears a little bit. Let's dive right into Whale Shark Mexico and your organization. What is your role, and what is, like, your day in and day out look like when you're not sailing across the South Pacific?
Yes. With the, in Whale Shark Mexico, the main thing is the research. You know, I am I'm a PhD, and I still strongly believe that it's very necessary to have a good data quality. And so we have a lot of field work, which is very, very nice. We have basically the whale sharks in La Paz Bay. Some years we've been having them year around, which is unnormal. And apparently this is more when we have El Niño event, where when we could have, like, the whale sharks year around. So we, during some years, we were doing field work year around. But for the last years, they've been mainly between October to April or May. We study not just the juveniles that aggregate near to the coast. We also have an adults, animals, May and June, which is a big challenge and are amazing to study them. Normally, for example, in the coast, we have the juveniles that the smallest is 2 meters, which is very cute. And the biggest could be 7-8 meters. But the average size there, or the common size, is 4 meters. And then we have the adults that they are mainly female, that apparent to be pregnant. And the size goes for 10 to 12 or even 14 meters. So they are huge. They are like a submarine.
Wow.
Yeah.
Big Some big girls. Girls.
Exactly. And so when we have the juveniles from October to April or May, we go 2 times per week to the ocean. And basically we go out and we collect data for the photo identification. The pattern of the spot of the whale shark is like a fingerprint, doesn't change even if the whale shark grew up. And we took the picture in both sides, left and right side, and it's behind of the gills. And we see if they are male or
right above the pectoral exactly. fins, right?
Yeah. And then we see if they are male or females, because the males, they have the organ of reproduction that is called clasper. So we just need to go a quick dive under the pelvic fin. If they have claspers, they are males, and if not, they are females. We measure them, the total length, and then we measure the dorsal, and we do like an scan to see any new or old injury that they could have. That is kind of the basic monitoring that we do. We collect the GPS as well, and we do all the research in the bay. And parallel of this, depending of the goal, depending of the year, it's been so many years, we can either collect a tissue sample. As I mentioned, I work a lot with genetics. It's been also used for know the contamination, they could have heavy metals or pesticides or microplastics. So we did some of research also on contamination on them. We can collect zooplankton also with a net. We work with drones in the past to see how the behavior changed with the presence or absence of the tourists or the boats or people swimming around them. The drones are still very helpful by the beginning or by the end of the season to find them. Sometimes it's hard to find them, but when we have a lot of them, it's easy to find them. We're just on the boat looking for the surface to the pectoral fin or the caudal fin. Or sometimes they just put on vertical position and start to feed. So basically, we are searching for a remoline on the surface. And we want to start a project with props, like to place like a GoPro cameras on the water with a little bit of that fish to attract like predators and see how other sharks around in the area. Because now it's protected, but the idea is will to have kind of the baseline to see how it's now in terms in other species, and maybe during the time to see if it's been helping another species as well, the protected area. So basically our time or the things that we do not always collect depend of the goal, but photo identification, injuries, GPS, and measurements, that's kind of the thing that we always then return to the office next day or so. Normally we go at least two times per week, and the rest we have to submit the pictures in the photo ID catalog, which is great. We have a software. And when I started, I have to print the pictures and to do it by eye, all the comparison. Now we have a software.
Does this look like this one? Crazy. Does this look like this one?
But now it's amazing. Now you just submit the picture in the catalog and it's very accurate. So, and it's very funny. And I love to see, like, we have animals that they've been returning 15 years or 8. Even one, I think the maximum, yeah, was like 17 or 16 years, then other 10 or 12 or 8 years. So you can see that the animal has a lot of fidelity. And we build the genetic, the Excel, the database to do the analysis. And that is kind of in general. But me as a director, when I was now, Alberto is the director. It was also a lot of paperwork to get the permits with the government, to submit grants, and to coordinate volunteers. Well, I was not coordinated, but it was the one that coordinated the volunteers. We involved people into the research. So that's mainly for the juveniles. And then when we have the adults, the females, everything changed. Even we know that from May to June, we have them. It's hard to predict when it's going to be the peak of the season. We work with a pilot that they do a lot of, basically he works for another company that are looking for megafauna for their tours. And he passed us the information for the wild sharks, so we can work once he found the wild sharks or when he start to see the wild sharks. So basically in May and June, we try to be as much as we can on the ocean. The La Paz Bay is a huge area. Normally to do the research in one side took us all day, and then to go to the other side has to be other day, because they could be the other side of the island or to Cerralvo. And we, during that time, it's beautiful because we also see other megafauna. So I love to see, it could be whales, dolphins, mobulas. And I love to see how the whale shark protection and protecting the animal and their habitat is also, it's called umbrella species, because are also protecting another animals around the area. It's one of my favorite moments of the year, studying the whale sharks there. And yeah, it's a lot of field work. And once we collect the data, we return, and the next day we go to the office. And or sometimes we go three or four times per week, and then just one day to the office, try to have the things kind of updated. Yeah.
That's awesome. That's a lot. It seems like one, you guys as an organization do a lot, and two, your role overseeing the organization was a lot. And it sounds like you were very hands-on, which one sounds so fun. And two, you know, you adding that little bit of extra work, outside of kind of the director administrative kind of stuff to be hands-on, you know, shows that passion that I was talking about earlier and the work ethic that you have. That's pretty amazing. And then on top of that, it sounds like, Koji, if we want to go film in Mexico, it sounds like we need to go there sometime in May. Am I getting that right?
It's the best time to me. I mean, it's a lot of effort because you don't see them all the time. But once they are there, we just try to go as much as we can. Yeah.
Yeah, I know that's definitely something that that we were looking forward to. I know it's been my dream. We already tried once and we flew out to Hawaii as a team and didn't get to see any whale sharks. We got a lot of whale shark stories, but didn't get to see any. So I know for 2024, that's really big on our list. And you were mentioning those cute 2-meter juvenile whale sharks. That's all I want to see now. I mean, I want to see some big mamas too. Don't get me wrong, but the juvenile whale sharks sound adorable. And
yeah,
I want
you're
to see
more
those.
Than welcome to come. And the easier way is go to the juveniles. It's more, we know they are there and we just go and normally found them. The peak of the season normally is December, January, and we have 40 animals at the same time feeding in a small area. It's just absolutely beautiful. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, the recommendation for the first time are those cute guys. And then once you have more time to, you can be, sometimes I recommend at least 2 weeks because maybe 1 week we don't have any. And sometimes we just go out and don't see any. For us, like a good season for the females is to have like a 13. That's huge. But if we have 4, we are happy, you know? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's definitely something I know we're looking forward to, as an organization. And of course, me particularly with that being, you know, my favorite animal. But now if the juveniles aggregate a lot in January, you know, I'm kind of looking forward to maybe, hey, Koji, we can do like a birthday trip out and see if we can see some juveniles. My birthday is in January, so that might be fun.
Of course.
Yeah, I'd love to get away from Florida in the winter. I don't like the cold.
I have bad news. It's the coldest time of the year. I mean, well, the coldest is March, but yeah, we have the peak of the season is in winter. But by December and January is not as cold as March. So, but yeah.
How cold does it get? Like 50?
I mean, the water could be 22, which is not bad. And sometimes like last year, because La Niña or this season, dropped to 19, but that's not normal. And it was more like March. But yeah, I will say 22. But the problem is you go out of the water and you have this cold wind, and it's the thing that you are cold, and then you have to jump again with the next whale shark and then go up and try to search them on the surface. So it's cold, and yeah, like I remember.
Well, 70 degree water doesn't sound bad to me. Over here on the West Coast in California, the water jumps down to, you know, low 60s in Fahrenheit. So that would be kind of that, you know, 18, 19 degrees Celsius for you. That is no thank you. But 22 degrees Celsius, I think Koji and I will take that all day.
Yeah, we have with La Niña, we have 19. I remember one day, it was in January, already worked. I don't remember. It was just one volunteer that arrived, and Arthur, it was taking his holidays, Christmas, and so I was taking the training for the volunteer. And so because I was training her, we worked like at 30, 32 whale sharks. And I collect all the data. I was exhausted and frozen. And the last two, I thought, no, I'm not jumping again. I'm so cold that we already have all this information that there is no reason to me to jump to the water. Yeah. But yeah,
I don't think if we jumped in water that cold, I don't think they could make a wetsuit thick enough that my nipples wouldn't try and cut through.
Yeah, no, to me, I was using 5 millimeters, so I was floating, and but yeah, it's not fun. But yeah, next year is El Nino, so or next season, so we'll see. It's normally warm, so perhaps January will be okay for you.
Yeah, I think we can make it by.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Well, awesome. Let's reel it back in. I know you kind of touched base on your role in the organization and what your organization does. Do you want to explain what the past whale shark season looked like? And maybe if you had any highlights, some good things that happened.
Well, the last season, it was quite interesting. It was the second, it was La Niña. And the previous season, it was also La Niña. And I'm talking about the juveniles. We didn't have, normally, it's from October to May where we can have the juveniles. But this normally changed year to year. So the last two seasons were La Niña, and we started to have like a good numbers for the whale shark by November. And this is very interesting, and this is why we can highlight the role or the importance of the research. Because normally to open the tourism activity is based on the number of the sharks, and which is low. I didn't like normally is open with 6 animals, which is very, very low. I think like a really 6 animals is not enough for a tourism. For the tourism. Even I know that it's very important. A lot of families depend on the whale sharks, and a lot of people visit us because the whale sharks, but we have to protect them, right? And is that noise here? Or it's okay. Sorry. So we need the numbers to be able to open the season. And then they started to aggregate, but they were very low numbers in compared with other years. And then by the end of January, the numbers dropped down, and the government, based on the numbers, they were less than 6, so they closed the season for tourism. But we continue doing our monitoring, and of course, everybody was kind of aware, like, what is happening. We don't know. We have meeting to know what is happening with the government and other researchers too. And to me, it was pretty obvious because La Niña, the previous season and the season, normally, if you think on how is the area of the of La Paz Bay and where the whale sharks aggregate, they aggregate next to a sandbar where during the winter time we have the northeast wind that they just come and hit the sandbar, and in that area in the tip we have kind of mangroves that they give the nutrients. So with the northeast wind, we have like the bloom for zooplankton, and then we have during the winter, normally, yeah, from October to May, we have this pattern, like 3 or 4 days of a strong north wind and then 3 or 4 days of calm. So this helps to keep the productivity. But what happened with La Niña, we have like 15 days of very strong wind, and then 2 or 3 days of calm, and then again a strong wind. What happened after, it was just a super blue, green water without zooplankton. So kind of no food, no sharks. But they didn't left the area. So they were just kind of like going out and coming in, or perhaps when we were doing the field work, because it's so green, it's hard to see them. But by the March, if I remember well, we have again a little bit of more whale sharks, and then the tourism open again. Even we said no, because we don't know if these numbers are going to be stable or they are going to drop down again very fast. But they open because But anyway, I think this helps because now the government is taking more seriously about we have the how many boats could be per day. But now it's very important to know the number of the sharks that we need to open or to close the season, and which is sometimes these things happen and are necessary to realize like it's something that we've been pushing, like six is not enough, we need more, and based on the science and information. So it was kind of very, very rare season normally, or this never happened before. And I was like, well, if we stop having these strong winds and then we have the common normal winds, we will continue having wild sharks. And that happened a little bit, but then by May, we have the south wind. And then because the south wind, there is not more production in the area. So that happened. And then, so the juveniles, basically with El Niño, we have less animals in good numbers and a shorter seasons, which is very interesting. And the Niño is the opposite. We have a lot of animals. And with the females, it's the opposite. We had were the most great, the most amazing seasons that we have last year and this year with La Niña. It's normally La Niña, cold waters, productivity. So both years we have between 12 or 13 mega mamas, and it was amazing. Normally with El Niño, we don't have not even one because it's so warm and no food. So it's very interesting to see, and it's one of the things that it's kind of the next things for wild sharks, to wild shark Mexico, to get more information, so for the oceanographic things, to try to link it a little bit more and understand more what is happening, not just these things like because I've been studying for a long time, I noticed it's because the wind, or it's because the productivity, right? But just to get, you know, science, you need the numbers. So, and yeah, but basically, yeah, we have an amazing, and it's very, very great. Like for the juveniles, normally for one season to the other, around 60% of the animals are, we know them for previous years. Like, for example, last season from the 76 animals, only 35 were new. The rest we already know. And we can see that the juveniles has a lot of fidelity. They like La Paz Bay. We have some animals that they stay more than 100 days. So they can, you can see that this place is a critical habitat for them. They have food, they have protection against predators. So that's why they like it. And the juvenile can return year after year. During 15 years or something like that, they have names. So we know them. It's very known. Like, it's very personal relationship. And the females is totally different story. We normally, at the beginning, I never see them again. To me, it was like where they go. I play satellite tags on them, and they show movements to Revilla Jijedo, which is out to the Baja Peninsula in the Pacific side. With the photo identification, I had some movements from the Gulf of California to Revilla Jijedo, and vice versa in a short period of time, like 6 months, something like that. But to have a recite for a female to the same locality, it was very rare. So it was kind of like, I don't see them. But last season and this season, finally, after 16 years, they return. After 8 years, they return. And it's very interesting to see, like, I believe personally that this returning is part of their cycle for reproduction in some way, is the thing that I think. And I'm looking forward to start to seeing one of my female juveniles now on my female adult aggregation. That haven't happened, but I felt like I'm getting very close to that. And it's very grateful to see. I mean, without continue doing my research, perhaps my conclusion will be like the adults just left the area and never come back. But because I've been continuing my research, now I know that they come back after 8 or 16 years. I believe that maybe 6 or 7 years, but perhaps I didn't see them. But then because it's kind of a cycle, no? 8 or 16. So I believe it's more something like that. So it's how I realized that how important are these long-term monitoring data. And that's why I felt like I would love that the Welsh or Mexico continue even without me, because I mean, now I'm taking a year, but maybe I will take more, or maybe I will do something else with my life. I'm not sure what's happened with me, but I'm sure what I want is that the NGO continue. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like you've left the organization in great hands. And, you know, regardless of, you know, whether you're involved with it or not, it seems like you've done enough to really move research on the animals forward. You know, being able to see that cycle in real time with one person, I think is important to the understanding of the species. I mean, not everyone gets the opportunity to focus on something for that 8 to 16 year period. Wow. Just because of funding, because let's be honest, funding is fucking hard to get. And I know we're going to talk about that a little later in the show, but, it's difficult. So it sounds like it's in good hands. And I hope you still get the opportunity to be involved in the research with the animals in any capacity. But I'm sure, you know, whatever the next step is, it'll be something impactful and amazing. Let's see what Koji's got queued up for us next.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Yeah, sorry, my dogs. No, Ethan, I think what you said is definitely on point there. You know, being able to trust your team and leave for a year is something that we aim to do one day as well. So hopefully we can tear a page from your book here in the future. But yeah, there's a shift that we can make into your current projects. I know you kind of touch base on you know, a lot here and there, but what are some of the current projects that are happening today with your organization?
Yeah. Now we are just getting ready for the next season. Currently, Beto is the one that is now taking care of the NGO. He went to Spain, but basically he's going to be, by the end of this month in La Paz, they started to get ready for the season in October. And currently, because he's new and he's starting, and it's great because it's these things that just happened that we have the season with the juveniles changed so much. And he just finished his master and he's been working with oceanographic data and information, and it things that we were not focusing much in the past. So now with Beto, we are going to start to collecting more of these oceanographic variables, and so plankton information, and also we are going to use a new tool that he did for his master with echo sondas in the area to have a bigger perspective of zooplankton and productivity on the area, which is, I think, is very important now. It's kind of a coincidence that happened that we have this change, and now it's kind of the expertise of the Exactly. It's because it's more like the Beto experience. But basically, I think it's great, no? That is one of the things that the project is needing, and now it's an expert or better than the master on this. So it's involving these new tools that he knows into the Welsh or Mexico, and into our monitoring program. And also, we've been trying to figure out the good places to place the props that are these cameras that you leave in the area. We've been just doing kind of the experiments in where to put them, and hopefully next season we will able to, because basically we've been putting the props and no predators or no fish. So just our volunteers, they are just watching a video with an empty ocean or just some fishes, but not very action. But we know that in the area, we have reports of hammerhead sharks. One time we helped, or we told to the government that it was a net, and it was in the wild shark area, and the wild sharks were feeding very close, and the government removed it, but they were only baby hammerhead sharks and also baby silky sharks. So we know that there are sharks. And so the idea is to see how the refuge is also helping to other species. So are there two projects that we are very, very excited to start and to incorporate into our the monitoring program. We are getting ready for the volunteers that will come also during the season with us. And I'm heading in November to the Revillagigedo expedition that is one of the places that absolutely have my heart. And I'm looking forward to see if one of the females that we found during the season on May in La Paz, now they are in Revillagigedo. This pattern has been happening in somehow. So I'm very looking forward to do this expedition as well.
Those sound like amazing projects that you guys have in the works and going on. And I'm excited for next season. I'm hoping, you know, with the switch from La Niña to El Niño, you know, provides, you know, a lot of animals for you guys to study. And I'm really excited to see, you know, via social media and hopefully, you know, maybe in person.
Yes, we are very, very excited. I'm expecting to have a long season too. Like last year, they left by middle of March, the juveniles. So I'm expecting to have a lot of them on May. So we'll see how the things are going on. But yes, we are also very excited to receive the wild sharks again in the bay and our volunteers and get ready with the probes and all the oceanographic data that we wanted to collect. And it's very good also, like for the refuge area, now we are starting with a scientific committee. So now we are going to be more researchers and putting our ideas for the management and conservation of the wild shark, which I think is great too.
Yeah. So this is our favorite part of the show, everyone. It's the wild stories segment of Wild and Unprotected. So Denny, I know this is something that we had talked about before that was going to be fun. So what kind of wild stories do you have for us? The ones that, you know, don't really get told, that can be a little kooky, crazy, sometimes borderline disgusting, sometimes borderline inappropriate. So what do you have for us?
To me, I even been thinking into write and share some of the stories because it's been really fascinating things to see and to be part, you know? Like I remember the first time that I was placing satellite tags on the whale sharks, on the big mamas. I collect tissue sample for juveniles. I place this in the Caribbean side because it's the biggest aggregation in the world. When we started, I mean, in some area surveys, you can count 400 animals. It's crazy. So imagine, yeah, it's amazing.
Holy shit.
And my goal, it was to collect tissue sample and then also the picture. But in some point, you go to the fieldwork and it's super hard to know if it's a new individual, if you already collect the data or not. And it's exhausted to collect data or to just jump to the water and see if already had the tissue sample hold, because we leave a little scar, exactly. And
scar.
So the government started the program and started to use this tax that is basically kind of a number. So it's not like a chip, it's just a number and a color. And so I was placing these ones also. And the animals there, you can see the average size, it's 8 meters, is bigger than in La Paz or the common size. And then they can have 10 meter sharks too. But so we were using just the pole spear. But collecting tissue samples for the big mamas, I knew that sometimes you just take the tissue sample and they, you don't get anything, and you just felt like it's so strong to get into the skin. So I was afraid how I will tag these mamas. And before that, I placed satellite tags on juveniles of 7 meters in La Paz, and I was using a spear gun, like a wood one, maybe of 8 centimeters, and you can have 3 bands, but I was using only 2 bands. And then I was like, okay, I will use 3 bands with these ones. But I knew that perhaps will not work. So I have a backup, the other spear gun. It's almost my size. I'm 160, so I'm not a tall person. And so I was, okay, I will use this and maybe, I don't know. At the beginning, I jumped to the big one, but I was, okay, I will use 2 bands, not the 3 bands. And I was super afraid, but I have to do it. And normally, the females, when I took the tissue sample, they don't react. They don't bother. They don't do anything. So we have the Sporan airplane. I was paying just for the research, just for taking the tissue sample. No one else was there. And it was fantastic how everything happened in one. The shark, it was feeding on vertical position. You normally don't see the animals, the females, on vertical feeding. Yeah, they are in horizontal. I mean, I have seen a lot of juveniles in vertical feeding. But the female, I mean, the female, the mouth is all, it's huge. The gills is my size. The tail is double my size. The dorsal fin is 1 meter. They are huge and amazing. So to see one on vertical position, it was just beautiful. And they were remoras around her and more. And I was like, I don't want to shoot her because I want to enjoy this. But I have paying this. You have to think on everything. And he was also reporting other sharks. And I have like, for a female, I have 5 or 8 or 7. I don't remember how many satellite tags to place. So I have to, okay, I cannot enjoy. I have to place the satellite tag and then go to the other because maybe tomorrow won't be anyone. And then I just get in position and shoot her. And then I just felt kind of a massive water coming through me. And then I just started to go forward, forward, forward. And then the tail just come past me. And I was like at that close. And they in the boat, they just saw like a huge item. It's like, oh no. And of course the tag didn't place. The tag was on the with me on the just on the spear. And I was like, come on, Rui. And I was like, why you are overreacting? But then I returned
because I almost got whacked by a whale shark. Would you not overreact?
And then I returned and I was so nervous. So I did again. Like, and then, okay, the 3 bands. And they were, are you okay? Are you confident? And I was like, yeah. I feel very confident in swimming next to them because I before I knew her movement. And then I just was able to do to move and to protect myself. I hit her again. It didn't work. And by the end, we placed the satellite tag shooting her from the boat. And by then, she was not reacting. She was okay. And then we did from the boat. Then for the next ones, it was okay. And I remember once placing the satellite tag. And then as soon as I shoot her, I have a remora on me. And then I just went to the boat and the remora. And then when I saw the remora, I told my friend, take the remora out on me. But then I was just focusing on tagging. And then the shark left. And then I went to the boat. And the remora, as soon as I hit I went out in the boat, the remora just left me. And I didn't know that the remora is still on me. And then on the boat, they just tried to save the remora. It was so much fun. And I love that story. And by the end, it's something that you learn and that you do. And now I know with 3 bands and the distance and the angle. But at the beginning, no one trained you exactly to do those things. You just have to. Now I have like my technique, or when I train someone to place a satellite tag or that is a sample, just breathe, feel comfortable, and then shoot. But by the beginning, it was like me doing the things, right?
It sounds like it was a process to learn. One, don't get whacked by the whale shark. Two, don't shoot yourself with the spear gun. And three, if you're close, I mean, there's obviously some symbiotic relationships going on with remoras and things like that. Don't bring one out of the water with you, where it's going to be chaos on the boat.
It was the remora, the shark reacting, and everything. But by the end, we were able to place the satellite tag. And one of my favorite stories too, it's when I started. And it was with a juvenile. That time when I went to Bahía de Los Ángeles, I worked with Abraham Vasquez. He is a doctor. His career is he's a medical doctor, but he's passionate about whale sharks. So during that time, he know the animals just with marks or things that he saw in the surface. So I felt like he teach me to recognize the animals. And they had a whale shark that they call it El Zorro. And it's the first animal that I was able to identify on the field. To me, it has a shape that to me, it was kind of
it looks like Zorro.
Native.
Like the sword movement.
That's why they name it there, because for them, it has just like a black line here on the hair.
Oh.
And for them, it was the Zorro mask, no? And that's why they call it Zorro. Yeah. But to me, the photo ID of this shark, it was kind of a indigenous native symbol. So to me, it was very unique thing that I was able to recognize him. And all the time that I saw El Zorro, I was like, oh, it's El Zorro, and I know him, you know? It was the first one that I was able to identify on the water and finally see that it's not just spots, that they have patterns that I can recognize. And that was in Bahía de Los Ángeles on October. And then in November, I'm not sure it was next year or just a month apart, I have this dream that I seen that I was in La Paz and that I be on the water, and then I saw El Zorro, and I was super excited because I know it was El Zorro and because he was coming from Bahía de Los Ángeles. And I remember that I dream on that in that the shark, it was in Punta Prieta, which is not the sandbar, it was in other place, but in La Paz Bay. And then I had the dream, but I was not like it was not very remarkable, but I just remember that I had this dream. And then maybe, I don't know, 15 days later or something like that, I went to the ocean, and in the sandbar in El Mogote, I saw El Zorro. And I was like, what? And I was like, I dream with this. And it's El Zorro, and it's coming from Bahía Los Angeles. And it's the first shark that is showing the movement between Bahía de Los Angeles and La Paz. I started with an Iconos 2. A submarine camera. I don't know if you are familiar with that, but it's not digital. It was for my father when he was doing his dive. But it was a very old camera that you have the, you know, this, how you call it in English? Film. So I was not able to see the picture. So I just went and print all the pictures to be able and to compare my pictures with the ones in Bahía de Los Angeles. And I love that because I dream, and I was like, at the beginning I was, oh, but I dreamed that the shark, it was in Punta Prieta, not in the Mogote, but I was, come on, Denis. I mean, it totally happened. And because of that, my boat is called El Zorro. Yeah. And then El
wow,
Zorro.
That's so cool.
Yeah. And then El Zorro continued coming maybe 5 or 3 years to La Paz. He was already big, so normally when they are close to be mature, they tend to leave for the Gulf of California. So, but yeah, I love it. It was my favorite shark for several years. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And recently also other magical things. I've been dreaming in doing an ultrasound on them and making the to be able to see the babies and to prove that they are pregnant. And that has to be
do an ultrasound on a whale shark?
Yeah, it's crazy.
How the hell would you do that? Hold on, let me get this ultrasound machine as I'm swimming through the water underneath this gigantic creature. Let me keep up swimming with Big Mama as well with an ultrasound machine.
I have done that. Yeah. I have done
that. Okay, that's impressive.
Yeah. The first one I was able to do in the Gigant Manta Ray in Ecuador, it was beautiful because she led me to scan her, and I saw when the baby was reacting because I was touching. And then on the film, I was able to see that the movements of the baby also because it was moving. It's been one of the most beautiful moments on my life. But I will this because the whale sharks. But then it was more easier for the mantas. But for the whale sharks, it was how I started my thing in Revilla to be able to do that because it's kind of diving and more often to see them. And I did in a female that she dove maybe 30, 35 meters and two times. In the same dive, I was able to scan her and I did it totally. The problem is like it was too deep and the scan started to get crazy. It was too deep for the machine. And then in some point, I was not able to see the screen. It was disappearing and coming up. But I didn't care. I just continued. Then I saw her again. So I did it again. And unfortunately, since then, and also I was able to place a satellite tag on her. So it was kind of also fascinating.
You're doing an ultrasound, placing satellite tags. So let me get this right. So we should have just reworked the intro to be, this is Denny Ramirez. She's PhD founder of Whale Shark Mexico. And she's an ultrasound technician on large animals as well.
I am not a professional on ultrasound. To me, it took me for a while to be able to see the image. For the manta, it was more easier because it's been done before in aquarium, so I knew what kind of image I was needed to look for or how we'll look at. For the whale shark, it wasn't done it before, so it was kind of, I will imagine that I will see a little baby inside of the egg or something like that, no? But yeah, it's one of the things that is still on my dream. We lose the machine, get water, it's not working anymore. And yeah, so it's one of the things that later I perhaps will love to try to do it again. The one that I did, it was very homemade. Ultrasound machine. That's why, and for the females, for the whale sharks, you have to be very deep. It's a project that is very, very expensive, and it's hard to get those things for these. But at least I prove that it's something that you can do it, and that it's a very good tool to do it. And but yes, we lost that, but. The end of the story of that female is that by the end, we saw that female in La Paz. So it was kind of beautiful to have everything on her, the ultrasound, the satellite tag, and the movement. And that time I was not able, in Revilla, the goal, it was also to play satellite tags and to do the machine, the ultrasound on the mantas. And I'm able to place a satellite tag on a manta and try to do the scan. But tagging a manta with a pole spear, to me it was too much to do both things. So someone else placed the satellite tag on the female. Sometimes you really need a team. It's very important to work as a team. But the manta I did by my own, and I really was like, I felt like a Christmas tree, just carrying so many things but doing everything together at the same time, which is also very, very passionate and amazing to see. And everybody says, like, I don't know how you do it, but once you see the wall shirt, you just... because during that time, I have kind of like a small fins, and it's like, you just see like a turbo. And then you just go. But that female, it was amazing. She let me to do the scan 2 times in the same dive, and even I was super deep, but... she let me, and then we saw her in the past. I felt like it's kind of a beautiful story, yeah, that I really like.
That's amazing. It's so cool being able to see those animals again and them cooperating enough with you to be able to get off those scans. That's unbelievable. Well, Koji, you think we're getting close to starting to wrap up the show?
Yeah, I think we've definitely uncovered a lot. Denny, thank you for sharing those stories. It definitely sounds like these whale sharks, they just know your energy. They can feel your energy, and they're like, oh, hey, yeah, we'll let you hang out with us. I feel like you you were just inviting for them. So it's probably why you have such good luck with your encounters. So thank you for sharing those stories. But yeah, like Ethan said, we're getting close to, you know, kind of wrapping up the show. This is a great part where you can, you know, tell the audience how to support and how to get in contact with Whale Shark Mexico.
Yeah, thank you. I've been enjoying the sharing and having this conversation too. Yes, there are different ways that they can support us. It's, as we already mentioned, that it's kind of very exhausted to just be chasing grants. So we started with a citizen science program before. We involve volunteers, and normally the volunteers could be from a month to 6 months, or for us, it's ideally time, or a good time is at least is 3 months, but we have some that they can stay longer. Normally, we like to have like a quality program, so we involve up to 4 at the same time, and it's from October to May. We are planning to extend that next year to Bahía de Los Ángeles, so we are looking forward to also continue in July, August, and September in Bahía de Los Ángeles. And the people can contact us through the website, which is whalesharkmexico.com, and there is the information of the volunteers, and there is also the contact info, which is info@whalesharkmexico.com. And we are also in a process with WWF. They've been supporting the program more than 10 years, but they are coming into a new administration things, and they will continue supporting maybe next year or by the next year. This year they cannot do it. So we are also looking for new grants or donations, so you can contact us for the NGO as well, for the website.
Yeah, anything to help you guys, you know, get funded. I know, you know, next year with it potentially being El Nino, there's a lot of research to be done, and next year is, you know, could be a crucial year with how many animals you might have on site. So if there are any listeners who are looking to support or help, whalesharkmexico.com is a great way to do it. And hopefully we can find you some sponsorship and help out, because we love programs like this.
Thank you. Yes. And we are also in social media, and social media is also Whale Shark Mexico.
Perfect. We'll see you there on social media.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you so much, guys.
And hopefully in Mexico.
Oh, yeah. More than welcome.
Yeah, well, we're definitely excited for all that. And we're so thankful to have had you on the show, finally being able to work this out. Thank you, Starlink, for holding up this entire time in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. I have to give props to Starlink. This is pretty damn cool. Yeah. So thank you again.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, really. So thank you again, Denny. We're so excited to finally have had you on the show. And I think we're good to go.
Yeah, no, thank you. I'm very happy and looking forward to see the results of the show.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Wild and Unprotected podcast, brought to you by Wildscape Productions. Follow us on social media at Wildscape Productions. For more information on our documentary series, Shoreline Stories, visit wildscapeproduction.com. Stay tuned for our future episodes, as we have so much more in store for Wild and Unprotected.